This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
We have to understand that in the last 5 years, Bouteflika was not really the ruler of Algeria, but in practice, others were ruling. So let's say that what happened yesterday is the end of round one in the political transition. But we still have second round, third round.
That's Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, talking about Algeria's president's resignation, details coming up. Also, a mass vaccination campaign against cholera has begun in Mozambique, and South Africa's Independent Electoral Commission says it's ready for next month's general election. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, as popular pressure mounted, Algerian state television announced late yesterday that President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has officially advised the Constitutional Council that he is stepping down. Algeria's constitution says the Speaker of the Upper House of Parliament, 77-year-old Abdelkader Ben Salah, will act as interim leader for up to 90 days, during which a presidential election must be organized. The resignation came shortly after the military demanded constitutional proceedings to vacate the presidency seat due to Bouteflika's illness. He has been in a wheelchair since a 2013 stroke. At the same time, many people say Bouteflika's departure is no longer enough, and they are determined to continue demonstrating, rejecting any transition that leaves power in the hands of the current system. The United States said the future of Algeria was now up to its people. Russia, a longtime ally of Algeria, called for a transition without foreign interference. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about what these developments mean for Algeria.
We have to understand that in the last 5 years, Bouteflika was not really the ruler of Algeria, but in practice, others were ruling. So let's say that what happened yesterday is the end of round one in the political transition. But we still have second round, third round. The second round that we expect is that, according to the Algerian Constitution, Article 102, it will be the parliament speaker. And there will be preparation for election, presidential election that should be held. And there has to be also reform of the electoral law in Algeria so that many candidates can be competing without any restrictions. And then you will have the election. But this is, again, will take some time, and it can also run into many obstacles. Any revolution in the world will always have counter-revolution. And so expect that this is not going to be different.
The army took the people's side, and that's exactly what happened in Egypt. With no leadership of the Algerian uprising and the lack of confidence in opposition parties, could the Algerian army repeat the same takeover?
Well, the Algerian army is different in the sense that they don't have something like staff in Egypt. The chief of staff who is leading the transition and going forward with the interests of the people historically has been helping the civilian control the army. This is not the case in Egypt. And so I don't see that we will get a repeat of the Egyptian case. Revolutions are not copied, but tactics are copied. So maybe they are learning from Egypt, also the Egyptian opposition and other oppositions are learning from the Algerian. But you cannot copycat what is happening in one country and impose it on another. Algerians have different experience. North African political culture is different. They have been influenced by the Tunisian experience. Remember, the neighbor is one of the most successful demographic transition cases in the Arab Spring. And so they are more influenced by their neighbor than by the faraway neighbor, Egypt.
So how would the success of popular protests in Algeria impact the future of popular uprisings in the region?
I don't think that you will get strong popular uprising without also regional and external support and strong preconditions. For example, at the same time that the Algerian revolt is taking place, you have something similar taking longer time in Sudan. But because regional power and external powers want to keep the system, they don't want chaos in Sudan, this conflict is dragging on for over 3 months since December, whereas we had a solution in Algeria or a beginning of the light. Remember, again, the Arab Spring in all those countries is different. Most of the Arab Springs, or all of the Arab Springs, happen in republics. It also came outside the existing political party system. It came from the street, from social movement, protest movement, independent people, NGOs, but not from the supposedly official political party system.
That was Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Mozambique and aid agencies have launched a cholera vaccination campaign in the city of Beira to treat nearly 1 million people affected by Cyclone Idai. Health officials are in a rush to stop the spread of the disease, which has killed at least 2 people in Beira and made more than 1,000 others sick. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Beira.
40-year-old Marcelo Sangolane is one of the hundreds of Mozambicans who lined up Wednesday to get a cholera vaccination in the port city of Beira. He says what he knows about cholera is that it is a deadly disease. If it spreads, it kills many people. I have to be here in line to prevent myself from getting cholera, says Sangolane. Mozambican officials and relief agencies launched a 7-day campaign in 4 districts in the country's center to combat the spread of cholera. The bacterial disease broke out after the cyclone's heavy winds and rains flooded sewers, spreading dirty water. Cyclone survivor Aida Francisco is leaving nothing to chance. She says she is in line because she fears the disease called cholera, because it is a disease that kills within 24 hours. That is why she is here to get the vaccination, says Francisco. Lucia Luis Francisco, a displaced mother in her 50s, was also lined up for one of 900,000 cholera vaccine doses sent to Mozambique. She says she wants to be clean and healthy because of cholera kills people. The government, with the help of medical aid agencies, has also set up centers to treat and isolate those infected. Maria Matsin is Mozambique's deputy health director.
We will stop the ongoing of outbreak and we will save lives. We will save people be sick, and we believe that if they don't become sick, they will have a good health, you know. Yeah, so it will help them on that, and they will be able to continue to doing their reconstruction, you know, that they lose houses, they lose many things.
Cholera causes severe diarrhea, which can lead to dehydration and death if left untreated. For survivors of Cyclone Idai, it is yet another challenge to face before relief can turn to recovery. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Beira, Mozambique.
South Africa's Independent Electoral Commission says it is ready for next month's general election. The commission doesn't foresee any problems and it's all systems go. From Johannesburg, Yashira Ramprasad has the story.
Just over a month remains before South Africa's national elections. The date, the 8th of May. There are 48 political parties contesting the poll. And as they continue campaigning for votes, the Independent Electoral Commission says it's ready to go. The IEC doesn't expect any major problems, but it's concerned about misleading information on social media that could influence the outcome. With 21 million Facebook and 8.3 million Twitter users in the country, social media is at the center of the political landscape. Chief Electoral Officer Sai Mamabolo says they've launched an online platform to monitor and curb any false information. Political parties and the public will be able to report deceptive social media posts to the IEC, after which a special panel will investigate.
This panel, which has expertise in media law, social media and disinformation, will assess and investigate the complaint and make a recommendation to the Commission for consideration.
Mamabolo says the IEC can then request social media outlets to remove the misinformation, ask political parties to provide clarity, and if necessary, institute criminal or civil litigation against the wrongdoer.
The site will contain a database of all complaints received and their progress so that other social media users can see if an issue has already been dealt with and what the outcome was.
While it will be difficult to monitor every social media post relating to the elections, the IEC hopes this will help keep misleading posts to a minimum. I'm Yashira Rambasad for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And in more news from that country, South African politicians are condemning a surge in xenophobic violence. Last week, at least three people died when South Africans attacked foreign-owned businesses and communities. Many South Africans fear that immigrants from other parts of Africa are stealing their jobs. Reporter Kudza Zenawashi has more from Harare.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, several cabinet ministers, and leaders of opposition parties have all condemned attacks against immigrants. A week ago, hundreds of residents from other African nations were forced to seek shelter at police stations and a mosque in Durban after rioters attacked their businesses and homes. There are concerns that a speech by Ramaphosa in January, in which he said his government would crack down on businesses illegally set up by immigrants, may have inspired some of the attackers. In Zimbabwe, the spokesperson for the opposition MDC alliance, Jacob Mafume, said Ramaphosa's sentiments were unfortunate.
We do not want to insert ourselves in the election cycle in South Africa. But what politicians in South Africa must realize is that Zimbabwean is both a domestic and an international issue for them. The statements by the president were unfortunate and they triggered a wave of xenophobic attack.
Monday, the South African Minister of Foreign Affairs, Lindiwe Sisulu, met with other African diplomats to discuss the issue.
What happened over the weekend, we believe, with the information available to us, was pure criminality. However, today we went beyond the matter of criminality and we dealt with a matter that some ambassadors feel is still xenophobic and happens on a regular basis, and we're going to sit down and deal with this matter.
Hundreds of thousands of Zimbabweans now live in South Africa, and in the past, some have been victims of xenophobic attacks. Valence Kuchera, a Zimbabwean living in Durban, says it is difficult for foreigners to report such attacks.
The problem that we have is most people, they do not have papers. So yes, they'll get hurt, but in my own opinion of what I've seen is they do not have a standing to go to the police station and reporting what happened to them. As you go to the police station, they obviously ask you for an ID of which you do not have. And then they start questioning you. How did you come here? How have you been living here?
Kuchera says that could end with victims being deported if they are undocumented. While the attacks have died down, there are fears of new attacks as South Africans, many of them frustrated by the country's high unemployment rate, prepare for national elections next month. For VOA, this is Kudza Zinawashe from Harare.
19 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. As the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide approaches on Sunday, we are bringing you a series of deeply moving profiles of men, women, and children who survived that terrible time. They are talking about the lives they lost, the lives they have found, and their hope for a new and better Rwanda. Today in the Survivor Series, let's hear from Innocent Gasingagwa, lost his wife, five of his children, parents, and all of his siblings in the genocide. A crowd broke down his door and started killing his family one by one with machetes. Gasingwa, who was 44 at the time, was slashed at the neck up to the left ear, fell, and was left for dead. The Red Cross took him to a hospital, but his prospects for survival were bleak. On several occasions, the Interahamwe militias pulled him out of the hospital to kill him with other injured Tutsis, but they brought him back each time for unknown reasons. Gasingwa has remarried and has three more children. The merchant got aid from a survivor's fund and used it to invest in his trade and build his house with two annexed complexes that he rents out. Gasingwa says his happiest moments involve removing genocide victims from mass graves so they can be buried with dignity. He feels it is his calling for surviving. He reveals that he is furious but doesn't know why.
What remains in my mind that I will never forget is the death of my wife and children. That still haunts me every time. I was hiding with them in the house, but I left first as I did not want to see them being killed. However, when I approached the door to go out, the invader struck me with a machete on the neck and I fell over. So I could listen whatever happened inside the house, even their screams. That image stays in my eyes, and I think it will stay with me till I die. You see, one's children is an important thing, the wife too. Therefore, in my life, that is the only thing which hurt me the most. Here is a blow of machete. You can see a scar here on my neck where I cannot see. Does not matter to me compared to the image of that day, the 7th of April. That one will remain with me all my life because it is the darkest moment I endured in my life. You see, I was a 44-year-old man and I had 7 children. All of them were killed in front of my eyes. That is an image that every parent will keep. You can forget any other thing, but not that one. I have already forgiven them in my mind, although none of them approached me to beg pardon. I did it in order to have a peace of mind. What I needed was peace. Our government granted it. So there was no reason to keep that hatred. That is why I decided to forgive them on my own. The hatred and the anger cannot bring back my family. There is nothing they can pay me to replace my wife and children. For me, the best thing I had to do so that I can go to heaven and meet them was to forgive their killers. Because keeping the anger always leads to bad thoughts. Now I feel free in me. I heard that some of the perpetrators were released, but I have no problem with that. I know they cannot dare to come and see me. I do not want to see them either, but even if I can come across them, I will not have any problem because I have already forgiven them. The country that I can give as an example is our Rwanda. When you see the way the genocide was carried out, and we still live with those who killed our families, you know the genocide was perpetrated by Hutus against Tutsis. And now we are living together without any problem.
That was Innocent Gasingwa, a survivor of Rwanda's genocide 25 years ago. The Ugandan government says gunmen have abducted a female American tourist and her driver in a national park near the Democratic Republic of Congo. A statement from government spokesman Afuono Opondo said four armed men kidnapped the tourist and her Ugandan driver inside Queen Elizabeth National Park early yesterday evening. Ugandan police have identified the tourist as Kimberly Sue Ancott, age 35, and the driver as Jean Paul. They say two other tourists who were held up by the gunmen but released alerted a park official to the kidnapping. It says the kidnappers, using the victim's mobile phone, have demanded a ransom of $500,000. The statement said Ugandan security teams have cut off all border crossings between Uganda and the Congo. Queen Elizabeth Park is Uganda's most visited national park. The United Nations Refugee Agency estimates that globally only one in four refugee adolescents are in secondary school, while the rest, most of them female, are not in school. An organization in Finland is trying to turn the fortunes for young refugees, as Halima Atumani reports from Kamwenge, Western Uganda.
For refugees like Amina Chimanuka, who fled conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo 4 years ago, survival, not education, is the priority. But as a refugee in Uganda's Rwanja settlement, she was among 500 students who graduated last month from a secondary school run by Finland's largest charity, Finn Church Aid. Chimanuka says she's now prepared to start her own sewing business. Previously, I would just sit home with no work. Luckily, they came and started registering us to go study. I registered, we did entry exams, I passed and went to study for 6 months. Now my life has changed because I can now earn some little money, she says. Finn Church Aid offers the students training in skills ranging from mechanics and welding to hairdressing and sandal making. Vil Vaklin, the manager of the project, says the training is equal to any found in a public school.
Our main goal is to have our diplomas recognized also in the neighboring countries such as DRC and South Sudan. Because when the time comes and these refugees are returning home, hopefully to a peaceful country, then they can still boost their employability in their new home countries and help to rebuild the societies.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates that only half of the children in refugee camps get any education at all. In Rwanda, those who don't get admitted into secondary school suffer, says the UNHCR's Chita Kang.
If they are not able to be accepted because of competition, where will they go? They become out of school youth. And sometimes, because of having nothing to do, being redundant in the settlement, they go into alcoholism or to anything that is bad vices.
But for refugees like Chimanuka that do get to study, the education provided by Finn Church Aid is literally life-changing. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kamwenge, Uganda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
This is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On April 7th, the United Nations marks the 25th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. More than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsi, were killed. An in-depth discussion of what Rwanda and the world has learned from this tragedy on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Good morning. Morning.
You are listening to VOA's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show with James Buddy. Good morning.